Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Jeremy Hoffer on the show. Jeremy is the lending manager for SelfHelp's Charter School Division, where he assists mission-oriented developers and nonprofit finance charter schools that lead to deep community impact. Before joining SelfHelp in 2018, he directed Access Plus Capital, a CDFI loan funding servicing small businesses. Over the course of 10 years, he developed and managed the fund, helping hundreds of Central Valley entrepreneurs get finance to start and expand their businesses. Jeremy is a board member of the Central California Land Trust and serves on several loan committees of community lenders in his hometown of Fresno. In addition, Jeremy is a co-founder of Porch Fest, an amazing outdoor music festival in the Tower District that takes place on a number of porches. Jeremy is also a talented musician and regularly plays live music around Fresno. Jeremy has a master's in community economic development from Southern New Hampshire University and an economic development professional certification from National Development Council. This is a great conversation. We talk about a lot of things related to business and music. I know you will love it. Let's go meet Jeremy, and Baker will take us there.
Little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best. Fresno's best.
Jeremy, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Well, you know, I find myself at Ocampo's a lot on Peach and Kings Canyon because that's right over by the branch where I work. I tend to like to walk to or bike to the restaurants that I go to. So if it's in the tower, I'm biking over to Banzai, get some pretty good sushi over there. Or maybe me and my partner will bike down to Sequoia Brewery and get a brew and, you know, and have some food there. But I'm doing my best to try not to eat out, but I still find myself, you know, getting that burrito at Ocampo's for lunch from time to time.
I haven't been to Ocampo's. What's your favorite thing on their menu?
I always order the two things. Either, you know, I get a California burrito, which is pretty solid, or I get the torta de carnitas and I ask for it crispy. So they make the carnitas a little extra crispy in there, and so that's kind of my go-to when I'm needing a little comfort food during the day.
Yeah, I find carnitas, like, I'm very particular about it because I want it to have crispiness, but sometimes you get those, I don't know, it kind of reminds me of like a bundle of hay or something where there's a string and it's just a thick fat wad of carnitas where you find yourself kind of chewing like you got taffy in your mouth. And I hate that experience. So I want smaller, crispier pieces, but that's rare. I feel like can Ocampo's accomplish that for me?
You know, I think they can do pretty much anything. They're a great family run business. I love the chewiness. I love the jerky. You know, I like beef jerky. I like anything that's dry and chewy. I'm weird that way. So, you know, I order my steaks a little bit medium, although I found out there's a medium rare plus. I didn't know that. Yeah, you can.
If it's already not confusing.
it's like between medium rare and medium. And so I'm going to give that a little try because the medium rare, it's just a little too bloody for me. But so I'm learning these things as I go, you know?
Yes. We all are developing our palates as we age. And I am going to take a super right turn now, or left turn, to talk about finances and lending, which is an area of specialty of yours. And I've got lots of questions around this. I want to start with kind of a broad one, though. When you're thinking about giving someone a loan, whether this is, and by someone, I mean an organization or an individual or something, what is the ratio between qualitative and quantitative factors that helps you make that decision?
It's a good question. Ultimately, it's got to boil down to numbers. Ultimately, if the numbers don't work, then it's extremely difficult. Now, that wasn't always the case in my lending career. When we started the loan fund, which was Fresno CDFI, it's Fresno Community Development Financial Institution, talk about a long name, back in 2008, we were doing a lot of startup loans really based on gut. You know, we were lucky if there was a, you know, we had the tax returns, and a lot of it was the story. And that was really fun. That was a fun time in my lending career because we were making dreams happen. You know, we were in a surprising amount of those entrepreneurs that we gave loans to in the early days. It worked out for. Casa de Tamales would be one of them. They're still around today. And that we gave them a startup loan back in the day. So there was a lot of qualitative early on. And then, you know, it seems like as the loan fund matured, and frankly, as kind of I grew in lending and became more and more skilled as a lender, you start to look at, you know, the ratios and it starts to boil down much more to the qualitative. But ultimately, you still need to tell the story around the numbers. So the numbers alone don't work. So I'd say 60-40.
Let's talk about your time at Access Plus Capital. How do you balance giving people money and ensuring that they spend it well? In other words, let's say, and this is pertinent because you just brought up Casa de Tamales. Let's say you're trying to fund a taqueria. They come to you, they need a micro or nano loan. But then you look at how they price food and you can see the items are not priced appropriately to get that marginal profit that they need in order to stay in business. How would you think about whether to give them money or not?
Yeah, it's a lot different if you're talking about a startup versus an existing company. If it's existing, you can just look at their historical financials and say, look, they know what they're doing. But, you know, a lot of those like very, you know, existing businesses go to banks and they don't need a CDFI like Access Plus Capital. And so what you're looking at is management experience. You're really looking at it at can you get behind this management? The man, you know, who is managing it, their experience. And if you see something, so technically there's this thing called lender liability. You, as a lender, you are not supposed to go in there and really give advice because ultimately that if you give a loan and you give advice, that business can come back and sue you and say, well, they told me that to do X, Y, and Z and it didn't work. And so lenders are very reticent to ever give any advice. That said, we have this term in the industry called technical assistance. And technical assistance or TA is kind of like riding that line between
That was literally my next question, is like, how do you distinguish between those?
it's just kind of, you know, it, TA is what I would like to, you know, I think the better way of doing TA is putting somebody in touch with somebody else that knows what they're doing. I think that's the best form of TA because as a lender, I didn't really know what to price. I mean, I had my gut, you know, I knew what I would pay for or whatever, but that's a very highly, you know, qualitative and subjective thing. So ultimately, the best thing you can do as a lender to provide TA, I think, is putting them in touch with peers, putting them in touch with information. And so we, you know, when we changed from Fresno CDFI to Access Plus Capital, I was part of the team that rebranded. The plus in the name was really about not only giving capital, but also access to information. And so if we could provide both capital and the access to peers, access to networks, access to information to these entrepreneurs that are a lot of times kind of operating in their own heads and what they feel is good and good pricing. If we could do that, we felt we would be more successful.
Yeah, because it feels like you're siloed in your particular business. I mean, some are part of a chamber of commerce where maybe they interact with people, but then you think about certain businesses, you know, like I've done some work with the Madera County Chamber of Commerce, and you know, there are certain industries that are not just not there as present with in those institutions where you get that kind of community support. And it seems like that is something that should be kind of built in, but I understand why it isn't. Now, when you're thinking about giving someone a loan, does it matter where the business is in town? So if you're thinking about, you know, a depressed part of town, quote unquote, does that factor in whether you give someone a loan or not?
Yeah, they say success is location, location, location. And so the tension with community development finance is that we need to focus on depressed areas. So the whole point of is focusing on depressed areas. And yet, you know, the facts are in depressed areas, there's less cash going around. There's you know, just it's harder to start a business. And so you have that tension. So, you know, one of the strategies, for instance, when I was involved in organizing farmers markets for a while, and one of the strategies was you don't to get a successful farmers market that serves low-income people, you need both low-income people and high-income people that so you put it in the middle, right? You find a census tract or an area where you could draw, you know, low-income neighborhoods and upper income or middle income neighborhoods. So
What's an
you
example of that in Fresno?
well, in Fresno, you know, the vineyard is I think you do find a mix in at the vineyard. A good example of a successful farmer's market was one that was formed inside of Selma Flea Market. And when EBT or the food stamps, when they went from paper to the card, all of a sudden farmers markets throughout California no longer could accept these paper because everybody needed a swipe. And so what we did is we went in and organized a farmers market within the Selma Flea Market. And that soon became the highest grossing farmers market in the state of California for food stamps. And that's an example of how do you get fresh fruits and vegetables to low-income communities? Well, you go where low-income communities are buying fresh fruits and vegetables, and you provide them with the support that they need to buy those vegetables. I mean, it's not rocket science, but that would be an example of a successful farmers market that actually was able to really reach a lot of low-income communities and families with fresh fruits and vegetables.
Okay. But circling back to kind of what we were discussing generally is how to think about location when you're lending to people. What's your kind of framework for that?
I'm sure a lot of your listener base has heard of redlining and what happened with communities and mortgages, and that entire neighborhoods were left out of being able to access mortgages and literally redlined out of it. So you have a whole industry of nonprofit lenders that exist because of the push to kind of equalize, to bring capital back to those communities. And so the number one thing when we were looking at would we help a certain entrepreneur, there were two things: location and their income. If they were a low income person starting a business in a high income area, we were all for it. That hit our mission, right? That was going to provide them with upward mobility. We would also provide loans to higher income individuals, but that were doing projects in low income areas, because that would then provide upward mobility to the people that were getting jobs, to the neighborhood. And so those were the kind of the two criteria that we looked at. So it wasn't just location, but it was, you know, there had to be an aspect of supporting low-income communities in there in order for it to be an eligible loan for us.
This is kind of adjacent to this topic, but I think it's relevant. Do you think this thing that was created under, I guess it was under Trump, these economic opportunity zones, tax structures, have they been a net positive, do you think, for communities like downtown Fresno? I know that's part of the motivation to build more things down there is these tax incentives.
You know, I don't know enough about opportunity zones. I'm much more involved in the new markets tax credit world, which really, you know, has focused on the same census tracts. The opportunity zones has worked to get more private capital in. I've read recent stories that there's been a significant amount of money that's gone into low-income census tracts. I think on the flip side, the criticism of it is that if you are savvy, you find a census tract that's already gentrifying, you find a census tract on the fringes, and then you get a ton of investment because everybody's going to make money.
Yeah, and that's so, what I was going to ask. Like, when does it transition out of that phase, and who gets to decide? And are there, like, you know, because that just feels like exactly what you're saying, which is, you know, if you can get in at the right moment, that's a huge boon for some, you know, private shark, if you will.
Right. Because everything's in transition, right? So there are areas of our town that are transitioning and gentrifying towards, you know, upper income. And then you have what are called severely distressed tracts, census tracts, that, you know, Southwest Fresno, for instance, that for years have been underinvested. And without a concerted effort to invest into those areas, they will never attract the opportunity zone money. And so that's why I still believe in the new markets tax credit world, which is a much more regulated world. There's plenty of criticisms about that program, but it provides, you know, millions and millions of dollars into what are severely distressed census tracts. And these are census tracts that would not be reached by the opportunity zone scheme.
Yeah, it seems like it's meant for fringe areas, maybe to push something over the edge, but not for the highly depressed areas that you're describing. Let's talk a little bit about PPP loans. Do you think that PPP loans have had a net positive impact, or in like the case of like someone like Bitwise, along with these kind of low interest or basically free money and stimulus loans, have they had a more negative impact? In other words, kind of what I'm asking is, you know, what we're experiencing now is that there's a lot of free money during COVID. Was that a poison pill for a lot of businesses?
Yeah, I think it was for a lot of businesses that it inflated them. We're facing what they're calling the fiscal cliff now, that a lot of businesses, and in my case, you know, I work with a lot of nonprofits that were kind of got a bunch of free money, and so their budgets were inflated. And so I wouldn't say poison pill, but they're having to face harsh realities that you know, you still have to make your bottom line work. But, you know, on the flip side, PPP went a long way in keeping a lot of businesses afloat, a lot of people and you know, jobs and people had money as a direct result of PPP. And I don't know that there would have been a better way to inject that much money right into the economy. Other countries tried various things. I really think that in the end, yeah, there was a lot of fraud. And so we're dealing with that now. And there probably was better ways to do it in certain ways, a little more checks and balances. But, you know, I was on the front lines of getting PPP loans approved. You know, we were working 12 hours a day, all hands on deck. Every people that weren't even loan officers were doing PPP loans to literally save some of these small businesses, entrepreneurs that were out there whose revenues had just completely dried up as a result of the shutdowns, which we needed to do, right? We needed to shut down. At the same time, everybody was kind of left hanging. So I like everything. I think it was a net positive, but there clearly we're reckoning with some of that fraud now that is coming out.
Yeah, I'm on the same team with you with that. I think it was necessary. And if you look at, you know, the way that, you know, some other countries, Germany, Japan, for example, are handling some of the inflationary pressure after the pandemic, we're doing well by all markers. I just wonder if there was a way to, you know, ensure some fiscal responsibility so businesses didn't expand beyond the scope, but maybe that was just impossible given all the different things that were going on in that situation. It would have been ideal, but I guess that's just kind of the nature of, you know, giving away some money. Some people are going to squirrel it away and be responsible, and some people are going to hire all their friends, all their family members, and bring everyone on the team and then face a round of layoffs once the money goes away. Why would a charter school, and this is where I'm, you know, I was in learning about your work and what you do, I will admit I have a big gap in this area. Why would a charter school, which is technically a public school, need a loan?
So charter laws that started was the first charter law was passed in Minnesota back in, I believe it was 93. And now there's something like 42 states that have charter laws. They basically approved these nonprofits to be able to access public funding, right? For the students that are enrolled. What they didn't approve was for public funding to go towards the facilities. So they had a way of operating, but they didn't have a way of actually having a building to operate in. And so there's charter schools have found a number of ways to get locations. You know, some of them rent from churches, some of them rent from strip malls. And then as they grow, they're able to build some wealth or some ability to then purchase their own buildings. And ultimately that's the most sustainable way, as we know, is to own your own building to long term. And so that has kind of resulted in a whole industry of nonprofit and for-profit lenders. Some are great actors, and some are, frankly, like in every industry, they're predatory. And so you've got just all kinds of lenders out there and financiers, you've got investors, developers that have made their business in developing schools around the country.
Mm. Now, when you're describing accruing wealth, how does that work in a charter school? How are they able to accrue funds to build? What are they accruing from?
So a lot of them have capital campaigns. They go out to the community and they raise funds. A majority of them are doing it that way over time. So, you know, you mentioned the pandemic. They were called ESSER funds. And I at the moment, it escapes me what that stands for. But these were funds that were specifically to help schools with their facility needs during the pandemic and beyond. And so they were, so a lot of schools actually came out of the pandemic with quite a bit of, you know, some money from the pandemic that they were then able to invest into a new facility. And you know, not every school has money to put towards a facility. Sometimes they need 100% financing, but a lot of times they'll put $1 million in and they'll need 10 million from a bank to buy a facility or to purchase it. So, you know, well-run charter schools their facility costs will be in the range of 10 to 15, 20% max of their total revenue. And so schools that are able to keep that lower and find the lower interest loan that you can get, or facilities that are donated, a lot of them get donated land, to the extent that they're able to get that piece subsidized, then on an ongoing basis, they're able to save money and you know, squirrel it away for a rainy day, or you know, keep it so that they're sustainable long term.
Okay. And you said before it's best to own your own building. Is that always the case, or is that specific situations? Is there some cases where charter schools, you know, if they're in a, you know, highly dense, expensive urban environment, makes more sense to lease or rent a building rather than trying to own something in a inflated market, for example?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it depends on the charter school's plans. So if they're in a growth mode, it's not always good to own your own building. It's good to lease for a time being and then at some point be ready to purchase. I think there's different strategies that different charter school networks take. For instance, in New York, like you mentioned, most charter schools that I've seen that I've worked with there are actually leasing on a long-term basis, 31 years from a developer in New York. And it just, you know, for whatever reason, that's what's done there. But I think overall the drive is to ultimately own your building so that you're building an asset into the future that you can leverage, whether it's selling that property to purchase a larger one. I think in general, what I've seen is nonprofits, by moving towards like having their own assets, it ensures a greater sustainability. It also, you know, a mortgage payment stays static for 30 years. If you get a 25, 30 year loan, it stays static, whereas your lease payments will go up to 3% every year, and that's what you're agreeing to. So you just, over time, back to kind of the percentage of revenues, you're able to drop that percentage of revenues over time and be saving money.
Okay. What kind of effects can having a large debt load do to a charter school? I mean, charter schools are different than other kinds of, you know, quote, businesses or organizations, or I don't even, yeah. I mean, I guess it's just a new mental framework that I'm thinking about is, you know, school having a debt load, you know?
It's weird. Yeah, it is. It's this kind of, it's a blend between two worlds. I mean, they go under. That's the number one reason for charter school closure. And the repercussions of that are horrible on communities, right? Students needing to find new places to go to school, teachers out of jobs, parents having to, you know, scramble to figure things out. And so, you know, a lot there have been, just as in the mortgage industry, there was kind of, you know, predatory loans that blew up in people's faces, just like that. There definitely have been arrangements that, where charter schools have gotten to the point where they have not been able to afford their mortgages. And sometimes it's because their own planning was off. They thought they were going to have 500 students and they ended up with 300 and they couldn't get past that point. And so they just, the economics of it just didn't work out. But that's ultimately the number one reason is fiscal foreclosure is really fiscal problems that these schools face.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. When you're meeting with like charter school leadership teams, do you feel like on average they have the kind of right resources in terms of, you know, accounting and business strategy and management and all the things that you need in order to factor in all of these complicated financial constraints to run a school?
Yeah, it's incredible when I meet with these school leaders, the amount of hats that they have to wear. I mean, you know, for a traditional public school, they're really just focused on that school and academics and the students and running teachers and running it well. A school leader at a charter school has to also then think about facilities, and they have a facilities person that they're engaged with. They have a back office provider for their finances. And so to the extent that, you know, and back to my comment about, you know, management, you know, that's the key is really getting, is understanding how strong the school leadership team is, what their experience has been, how many other schools have they been involved with, how long is their track record, who do they have on their team, who's their back office provider, who's providing their facilities support. So there's a number of things that go into analyzing these, you know, these charter school projects beyond just the raw enrollment numbers and you know, the raw revenues and expenses.
Gotcha. I'm going to make another hard right turn, and we're going to talk about Porch Fest now.
Welcome to my life.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like two kind of very, you know, maybe left brain, right brain kind of is the metaphor here. Is Porch Fest an anarchic event?
So I got to visit Burning Man for the first time in 2019.
Okay.
And I would say it's closely patterned and organized after some of the principles of the way that Burning Man is organized. In that, at Burning Man, you have the central nonprofit that provides infrastructure and provides information, and then you have the camps, and each camp is on its own in curating what they do, and it's the camps that really drive ticket sales, and so. The Burning Man provides a certain number of tickets to each camp based on how many years that camp has been around. And so that's the brilliance of it, is that by having the camps kind of it's a decentralized, I wouldn't say anarchic, I would say it's a decentralized approach to organization. And so in the same way, we treat the porches as they're their own venue. And our job is to support the porches, and so and provide that infrastructure, the marketing, the hype, all of that for the porches. And so, you know, whenever a performer comes to me and says, "Hey, I want to play Porch Fest. You know, how do I get?" It's a great, find a porch, yeah. And that's kind of, and then I lead, you know, I point them to the Friends of Tower Porch Fest Facebook page, and I say, you know, talk to some neighbors, you know, talk to people. It's really about like. It's about what you make it. So in that extent, I would say it's more decentralized.
Hmm. Well, there's always a lot of stakeholders involved when you have a big events in cities. I want you to talk about two of them. One, the city of Fresno, and two, cranky neighbors. How do you deal with each of these two stakeholders?
So the city of Fresno has just been, it's about being transparent, upfront, early with communications, building allies inside the city, both on the council and within their departments, and just understanding what their concerns are and addressing them. And for the most part, I think we have been successful at showing that we're a partner to the city, that their goals are our goals. We want to promote this community. We want a safe event. We want, you know, we want people to have a good experience on the day of. And so far they've been a tremendous support, and we hope and intend to keep it that way. Cranky neighbors are, that is kind of the X factor that you just, you know, you never know when something's going to happen. And so that's kind of still, that's a big unknown in a lot of cases, but in a big way, it's a similar strategy, which is facing them head on. Let me give you an example. We had a one neighbor start like blasting us about how there was going to be a very loud party at one of our sponsors, and I won't name them, but you know, one of the sponsors was having they were a porch sponsor. And as part of being a porch sponsor, they were going to curate their own events throughout the day. Then we were going to help promote them. And that neighbor was living behind this given sponsor. And she was complaining about the noise that was there. And it wasn't just Porch Fest. This had been years of this neighbor experiencing noise from them. And so what I did was I arranged a time. I met with her at her house. She brought me into her house. She closed the door. And sure enough, you could just hear the sound. And I empathized with her. I mean, I said, you know, I hear the issue, and you know, this is kind of out of our control, but here's some people you might be able to kind of, you know, talk to about it. And I encourage you. So it didn't, I don't know that it would ever resolve their problem, but it was, I think they felt by being heard. That's like a big piece of it. The worst thing you can do, I think, is just ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist. Now, sound bleed is a potential ongoing problem with the way that we structure things, because, you know, by putting it, in a sense, it is anarchic because anybody can start a porch, right? We don't curate the porches like most porches, porch fests across the country. They curate the porches, so they make sure that sound bleed isn't going to be there. And so what we're doing is early, we're identifying potential issues early on, and we're literally getting the neighbors together. So we're saying, you guys work together on this. You know, you guys are across the street. Why don't you guys stagger it? And so we're providing that kind of connection and support. And so that at least it's not the day of that they're like, oh no, there's, you know, all this noise bleed is happening. We're hoping to head that off. And it's an experiment in the making. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, that's the nature of cities, is right. Is everything's always colliding. And when I brought up noise regulations with Elliot Balch, his response was, "Well, you live in the city, so this is just kind of the nature of being in that environment." And I used to live in a 12-story high rise in San Francisco, and my neighbor was an aspiring guitarist in a Slayer cover band, and so there was some things I had to learn about how to survive in that environment. I think at one point I offered to get him some really nice instrument jack noise canceling headphones, which he rejected, but it's neither here nor there.
Nice.
Can you talk about the ripple effects of this in terms of community development? I often think about standalone events like Porch Fest, for example, and how they impact a community differently than something that's like a reoccurring event, like, for example, like Art Hop. Mm-hmm. So how do you think about community development in that respect?
Yeah, I mean, something that's unique about Porch Fest versus other events, really almost any other event except something like Art, I think Art Hop is a great example, is that the venues are literally residents of a community. So the venues, the people that are organizing these events have been there, and some of them have been with us for 4 years. And it is now, we now have a network of porch hosts that we're building and that we're connecting to one another. We're putting together on a Facebook group so that they can share their own experiences. We prepare kind of goodie bags for them beforehand so we can get information to them, and we can and so there's this level of ownership and buy-in that I think is unique to Porch Fest as a festival. Whereas if we had set up one big stage at the center of tower and just had the event and blew it out, had a ton of people come and leave, I think everybody would have, you know, a great time. And it's nothing against that kind of festival, but there's a certain staying power of really putting the ownership in the hands of the residents themselves that I think is unique. And we're seeing it play out now, and this is our fourth year, and we have people that are just fanatical about Porch Fest as a way of building community and as a way of them having pride in their community, in their neighborhood.
Can you share a favorite memory at a particular porch or a particular concert that you listen to, something that stands out in your mind?
There's so many. I think I would share more of my experience of getting on the bike. So one of the best parts of organizing Porch Fest is by the time Porch Fest happens, the work's done. So that's another thing that's unique. I get to then jump on a bike and check it out. Of course, we're at the info booth, we're at the merch booth, and we make sure that we do shifts so that we get to actually enjoy the day and not just sit there. And so my best memory is just getting on a bike with my son, who at the time was 16, and hopping from porch to porch with him on bikes. And we went to a drum circle. They've been doing drums for that now. This will be their fourth year. and joining the drum circle with a group of, you know, neighbors there, and then jumping on our bikes and going and seeing like a Metallica cover band, and then going and seeing a jazz band. And then, and it's that, that just kind of bouncing and seeing all of these little mini kind of block parties or mini lawn parties that were being put on. Some people serving tamales out of their front. Somebody was giving, giving everybody popsicles. I mean, just, it's infinite, the amount of kind of permutations or, you know, the amount, the different ways that people are expressing this gift that they're giving to their neighbors, to the community. And so just being able to experience that within a span of, you know, an hour, being able to see all of these different bands, and all, it's just, there's nothing quite like it.
Yeah. We're going to now jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. You tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. The first one is Me and Ed's Pizza.
Overrated. Sorry, everybody that loves Me and Ed's. I just don't like Me and Ed's Pizza.
I think you could just leave it at that. That's fine.
I'm a Pacifica guy, you know,
it's subjective taste and preference.
It's totally subjective. So to all you Me and Ed's lovers, that no worries. Sorry.
Okay. Next one, Toots Hibbert, over or underrated?
Underrated of Toots and the Maytals?
Yeah,
underrated. I mean, absolutely. That you know, I play a number of Toots songs, and just he paved the way for so many other artists, and to still, yeah, just definitely underrated.
Love so if that. Someone's only listening to Bob Marley, do you think it's an easy transition to Toots for them?
Absolutely. I think Toots and the Maytals, any of that old roots music, roots reggae stuff that came out in the 70s. And, I think Bob Marley is really just a gateway drug to that, to like learning more and going deeper and deeper.
Okay. Next one, Ostrich Land.
Underrated and really unknown probably by many. Let's see, me and my partner, Amy, we were on our way to Solvang and just saw like passed it by, and we looked at each other. We saw the big sign for Ostrich Land, and we were just like, yeah, we're doing it.
Did you feed them? What did you do?
Oh yeah. You go there, you pay, I think it was $7 to get in. You pay another $1 for the food, and you go up there and they just like peck at the food. And I even had one running alongside of me, and like people were taking video of it. Like I was just connected in lockstep with this ostrich. They're just such amazing beings. And so definitely worth your time and $15.
An often overlooked instrument, the tuba, over or underrated?
Oh my God, the tuba is definitely underrated. You know, my friend Kevin Hill, you know, once you see him jamming on that tuba and holding it down, you'll never go back. You know, you just, the tuba just gives you that, it hits you in the gut, and it's just such an awesome instrument. You know, I would go one more step. I'd say the sousaphone would just be that next level too. Yeah. You know, this, definitely underrated.
All right. Next one. Mardi Gras in Fresno.
I'd say it's underrated. Also, I love Mardi Gras in Fresno. You go there and it's no New Orleans, and you know, but damn it, we're trying our best. We're doing
I kid you not, I did hear someone there stand outside of a bar smoking a cigarette, and I heard him say, yeah, this is basically the same as New Orleans. I was like, okay. But like, I get it. You're hyping it. I get it.
Something really charming about everybody that does try that, you know, trying their best, getting together and making the most out of what is nowhere near what the New Orleans celebration is. But you got to remember, New Orleans, they're like professionals at it. They think about it year round. They party year round. Mm-hmm. Here in Fresno, you know, we do our best on that day. It's neighbors coming out. It's a lot of Tower District people. You know, these are families that walk down the block and cheer. And when those kids get the beads or a piece of candy or whatever it is, they have joy on their face. It's awesome. I love Mardi Gras and the Tower.
Okay, next one. The MySpace music player.
I don't even know it. It must be underrated too. I don't know. What do you think?
I was in a lot of bands in high school and college, and the MySpace music player before Facebook, you know, destroyed it, was an amazing community development tool for spreading your music, and I miss it. And I'm, you know, we're going to talk about SoundCloud in a second, but I think, yeah, there's an element that I miss. Let me jump to the next one. This one is important because I am learning. I like many people, had a very mean piano teacher as a child. And now as an adult, I'm trying to pick it back up again. Do you think there's still a lot of value in having an actual physical music teacher, or are the online tools that are now available so good that it's creating a situation in which you can do, let's say, 80% of the work before you get a teacher for that final 20% of working through the really difficult stuff?
Yeah, it's a good question. I love the online tools, and like now, you know, the VR headset, I think they call it Piano Vision. It's incredible. You know, you put that VR on and it shows you the keys. It shows you everything. You know, you can see through it. Right. So mixed reality, you know, the sheet music is up there and everything. But what I've noticed, you miss that accountability of having a real live teacher, and that lesson that you've got to get to and on a weekly basis and perform for, and you better, you know, and you know, yeah, a lot of teachers might be mean, but if you still want to impress them, and that's kind of missing. Maybe they need to add that to the VR,
like an angry person that stares over your shoulder,
like teacher that's like, yeah, that's like you stupid,
yeah. All right, now I'm just going to give you a bunch of either ors, and you just pick one. I don't want any explanation. I want it to be enigmatic. Okay, first one: tube versus solid state amps.
Tube.
Bandcamp or SoundCloud?
SoundCloud.
Okay. Fender or Gibson? Large venue or small venue?
Small venue.
In ear or floor monitor?
Floor.
And flute or piccolo?
Flute.
Okay, wonderful. All right, just a couple more questions before we wrap up. What is it about the culture of playing music live that you love personally?
I love the way that music brings people together. I think there's a magic in the way that music can draw people and get them in the same space together, whether it's the musicians on stage together or it's people in the audience. And more, as people are more accustomed to, you know, music that's been kind of pre-curated by DJs and stuff, there's an element of risk that is no longer in music when you go to a DJ. It's kind of, it feels a little more prescriptive. It's great. I mean, it's awesome music. What the stuff DJs are doing, it really gets emotions going and people get hyped. But there's an element of risk that musicians are engaged when a musician is taking a solo, that solo, they could make a mistake. There could be, and if they're, you know, there's that kind of uncertainty about where things are going to go that I think draws people and makes people really engaged. And so I think that's what I love about live music.
What's your concern about AI and songwriting? Do you have them, or do you think it's overblown?
It's funny. I'm a proponent of AI in my professional life. So the first part of what we talked about, because I think it's just gonna, it's already really made a lot of my work more efficient, and we can focus on relationships. But on my creative side, I'm really concerned. I think that it takes the soul out of creation and the creative process. And I think there's something that people need to learn by just doing and making mistakes and trying again and being inspired and then being uninspired and all of that process of the creative process that if you just kind of like give it a prompt and say, I want this feel, that you it just shortcuts all of that process. And so I think that's my concern, is more on the creativity angle.
Yeah, I read an interesting article a while ago, and it was looking at developments in songwriting. And one of the things it talked about is that songs have less emphasis on cohesion and more emphasis on particular moments of break where you can chop something out and it can become part of an Instagram reel, for example, where you can just have this specific moment in a song that people attach to. But the nature of songwriting is changing in that we like these truncated, smaller component pieces. Are you seeing that when you hear musicians in Fresno, or is that something that you think is more of a music industry strategy built around social media?
I wouldn't say I see it in musicians in Fresno, and I think that's why I really want to continue to support the music scene. I think that the musicians in Fresno are supporting each other in good songwriting and in creating a cohesive presentation. So you know, a whole song, but also a whole set, you know, and not just focused on that one how that one moment sounds or that one drop sounds. Yeah, I think that I don't I think it's more of a larger music industry thing. And Fresno's a little bit buffered from that because we don't have the same competitive like situation that musicians in LA likely have. Like you probably have to be a lot more music industry minded to be in the music industry in LA or even San Francisco, maybe. Whereas Fresno, we're a bit of an island. And so, you know, we started a reggae band 5 years ago because there was no other reggae band that was playing roots. You know, we started playing Toots and the Maytals, actually. But if we were in Santa Cruz or in LA, we would have just been another white boy reggae band, you know, the dime a dozen. So something beautiful about being in a scene where you can create and be unique, at least in our little microcosm here. And then hopefully you get good enough to then go out into the world and be on that same stage as the other bands in other areas.
Let's say I somehow got you appointed as the music czar for Fresno. You were in charge of making the Fresno music scene more vibrant and healthy. What's one or two changes you would make to just how the city works that would encourage more people to pursue live music?
Yeah, I think I've heard of murmurs of like a musicians union or something that would give a stronger voice to musicians. I think that's all in the effort of really pushing venues to actually pay better and pay what musicians are worth for their time. That said, there's a lot of people that are just starting out or starting a band, so they're willing to take whatever they can get. They'll play for free, frankly, in a lot of cases. So if you're an experienced musician that depends on music for your daily bread, it's hard to make it here in Fresno. I think the idea that you can just make it in Fresno on a long-term basis, the strategy needs to be more about going out to and finding a festival circuit or a niche and maybe traveling a little bit and not just depending on Fresno. But in order to get there to where somebody make it as a you know, in the industry here in Fresno on an ongoing basis, venues need to step up and recognize and that the worth of these bands, especially the ones that are a lot more experienced and are asking for more money, basically, for what they're doing.
This is something I ask most people I have on. I like for them to kind of reflect on the industries that they're involved in and talk about how that shapes how they see the city. So, for example, I work in public education, and so I tend to see the world through that lens in terms of problems and solutions. You know, you have your hands in two very specific areas. I'm interested in how they kind of combine to shape how you see the city.
I'm still figuring that out. I'm a musician banker, and it's an interesting perspective. For a long time, you know, it felt like very conflictive. You know, like the banker, I needed to be up early in the morning, and the musician, I needed to be up late at night, and it was like burning a candle at two ends. And I've begun to really see it from a perspective of balance and right brain, left brain, kind of what we alluded to earlier. And so I think that's how I'm seeing things a little bit more, is that you know, in order to have a healthy city, we need to have a good balance between these two sides of our society, between the creatives and the professional class. And they both need to recognize the value of each other. And frankly, I think the musician and the creative class needs to be seen more by the professional class and valued more. And so whether, you know, however that plays out, whether it's through creating things like Porch Fest festivals that highlight and hiring musicians for private parties and really, you know, bringing bands in versus in DJs too. But so I guess it's from a perspective of that balance that I'm beginning to see things, but I'm still figuring it out, because some days I'm just like, what are you doing, dude? Like, it's, you know, you get tired sometimes, but then other times I'm so fired up from a gig that I played, you know, the Saturday before, and Monday morning I'm like, let's go. I can talk to any CEO now. I just did that, you know? So it's finding the balance in between, I think.
Sounds like being a human to me. Let's close where we always do, which is book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
Oh, man, I knew you were going to ask me this. I'm really not a reader, and I wish I was. I've started a number of books and I don't finish them.
Okay. That's okay. Yeah. I start lots of books and don't finish them. That's a normal thing.
I read the comments on Reddit. So I get into, so geography is it, the subreddit geography is fascinating. You know, you get in there and there, I'm just amazed at how much time people spend commenting and really insightful, long comments sometimes with, you know, citations and stuff. And I learn a ton from that. Data is beautiful. That's another subreddit that I just love. And you just get into just this random nooks of human thought and experience.
Thank you for bringing this up. No one has brought up Reddit during book recommendations. And I love that because I spend an incredible amount of time on there and haven't had anyone to talk to about it. There's one where they post a random picture around the globe through a window, and you got to figure out where they are. And people like post their process for like how to try and identify landmarks and certain types of electrical wire. And it's incredible. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
so it's a beautiful community. Yeah.
It is a beautiful community. I don't think it used to get a really bad rap, and I think it used to be kind of a little darker, and it's emerged into being just a great community of people that are trying to help each other out. I began to snore, and it's a new thing for me. And so now I joined the snoring subreddit, and I'm and I'm getting all kinds of support and giving all kinds of support. So, you know, you can really find your little community there. And so, yeah, I wish I had a great answer of like three books that are just firing me up. But I my spare time, I frankly practice music, and I really try to, you know, I have kids and a family, and I just spend time with them. And so I don't do as much reading as I wish I could.
Fair enough. To close, where can people find out more about Porch Fest, about your professional life and your work you do? You have a lot of kind of links to walk us through. So why don't you give us kind of like the logistics about where to find out, and then talk about this year's Porch Fest.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll just start off with Porch Fest. TowerPorchFest.org is where people can go to get information about the celebration coming up on April 27th, 2024, but we have it every year in April. Find out how to get engaged. And then, you know, my musical endeavor is Boha, B-O-H-A. And you can find us at bohareggae.com. And then I work for a credit union called Self Help Credit Union. And you can just Google Self Help. I actually, my headquarters is in Durham, North Carolina. And we have a branch here in Fresno at Kings Canyon in Clovis. And I just really love self-help. We're reaching a population with our retail branches that, you know, frankly, are going to payday lenders or check cashers. And we're working with this population to introduce them to fair lending products and savings and credit building and financial literacy. And so definitely something to check out if you want to support a great nonprofit financial institution. Come on over and open an account, Self-Help Federal Credit Union.
And did you say the date for this year's Porch Fest? When is the date?
Sure. It's April 27th on a Saturday. And we will have a pre-party at Goldstein's on April 12th. Which will be a chance to pick up some early merch and hang out, listen to some of the, we're going to have an open mic from some of the porches are going to share about what they're doing. There's going to be a band there, Dying Sons and Sunumbra are going to be playing that night. And so it's going to be a big party on April 12th, but then the big one is Porch Fest on April 27th.
Well, I really appreciate you talking to me, Jeremy. This was a lot of fun. I had 600 other questions to ask you about music, but we didn't have time. So I'll maybe have to have you back on in the future so we can talk more about SoundCloud and tubas and whatnot. So thanks again for doing this. I really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating or review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.